Let's talk about the English plays. So Shakespeare wrote, I guess, 3 Roman plays, maybe 1 or 2 more, depending on what you count, but what, 10, I think?
10
English plays,
yeah.
Not counting, I guess, a couple that are set, the King Lear, Macbeth, yeah, which are kind of English, but the okay. King John through, what, Henry VIII,
yeah,
which are really consecutive, yeah, almost, well, yeah, with some skipping around within, but so what's the sort of overall theme, point, what is he teaching us?
Well, the heart of these plays is what we call the second tetralogy. That's Richard II, Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, and Henry V. There's the first tetralogy, the 3 Henry VI plays and Richard III. What's odd is Shakespeare wrote about the later historical events earliest, and then there's these 2 separate plays, King John and Henry VIII. I think Shakespeare was very interested in the issue of kingship. I mean, he was living under a monarchy, chose to, insofar as interested in politics, he chose to examine monarchy. He's writing for an English audience. I think he understood these plays would be very popular. By the way, he more or less created the genre. I mean, a lot of people wrote history plays after. Marlowe had written some before him, but it's Shakespeare who made the most sustained effort in the area. 10 out of his 37 plays, so it was very important to him. Now, traditionally, in literary criticism, people had assumed Shakespeare was an uncritical supporter of the English monarchy. I think he really was thinking about the monarchy and how it might be reformed. For example, I think he understood the greatest effect of monarchy was succession, that no matter how good a king might be, there was no guarantee that his son or daughter would be equal. That's just something Shakespeare shows, in effect, when Henry VI succeeds Henry V. Henry V, probably the greatest king Shakespeare ever portrayed, but his son, part because he came to the throne as a child, doesn't work out as a king. Moreover, I think Shakespeare is interested in the way being brought up to the throne is a corrupting influence, and something he shows about Richard II, and much of the Henry IV plays, I think, are designed to show how a king might get a good education. So I don't think Shakespeare was an uncritical supporter of monarchy as a form of government in the abstract. So that, for example, he shows an unusual interest in republics for someone who's supposed to be just supporting monarchy. And we talked about the Roman Republic. Venice as a republic is another example. So I think what's going on in the plays is Shakespeare is accepting the fact that England's a monarchy. He's not going to try to bring about a revolution and institute a republic. But I think he was interested, how could we reform the monarchy and maybe move it more in the direction of a republic? And that, I think, is the key to the story of Henry IV and Henry V. And here it shows the interrelation of Shakespeare's work, that what he's learned about Rome is relevant to what he shows about Britain. Again, Rome was famous for a mixed regime that combined elements of monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. And I think Shakespeare thought something like that would be plausible for England. And here, again, I go back to the fact that I originally developed my interest in Shakespeare and politics in Harvey Mansfield's course, Gov 112C. And there, this was exactly the continuity we studied, that we studied ancient Rome as a mixed regime. And then we looked at the 18th century British monarchy as a mixed regime, because after all, Britain had a monarch, a House of Lords, and a House of Commons, and famously it combined monarchic, aristocratic, and democratic elements. And I don't want to give Shakespeare credit for this, but I also wouldn't exclude his influence, because what he shows in the Henry V plays, Henry V and then the Henry IV plays, is that this is what a good monarch would do. He would learn to accommodate the nobles in his regime and give a popular touch to his kingdom. So the point about Henry V, the man we know as Prince Hal in the Henry IV plays, is in his youth he goes among his people. He says, "I've learned to drink with every tinker in his own language." He knows the slang of the common people. That's going to come in good stead to him when he becomes monarch and knows how to talk to people in their own language. And what we see in Henry V is a monarch who very cleverly has chosen to make a claim to the French throne and lead a war against France. That accommodates his nobles. It gives him, gives them something to look forward to win glory, to win lands. And he makes a big deal the night before the Battle of Agincourt. You stand behind me now, and every one of you will gentle your condition. I'm going to ennoble you. And then in terms of the people, he gives them a national cause to get behind. He has a couple of conversations where the people say, we got to stop arguing with each other. We got the French to worry about. And he really does have a common touch, a little touch of Harry in the night, as Shakespeare puts it. And in a curious way, that play, which has been always, you know, popular in England, the great patriotic story of Henry V, I think that held up a model that the English monarchs understood, that the monarchy could not be aloof. Shakespeare presents the French in that play as medieval aristocrats riding sonnets to their horses, living in a world of chivalry, completely out of touch with their people, utter contempt for the British and their common soldiers. Henry V puts together a citizen soldier army. And that's why it triumphs. And again, I'm not saying Shakespeare created modern Britain, but I wouldn't underestimate the influence of those plays. People have called these plays the Henriad, as if they were the Iliad, as if these were the epic of the English people. And you do see famous Englishmen, famous politicians referring to these plays. And I think Shakespeare thought you could make the monarchy stronger by making it more accommodating to the nobles and also to the people. It's an interesting thing about Shakespeare, though, when we're talking about Shakespeare and politics, he does not seem to be particularly interested in the institutional aspects of politics. It has upset some of my colleagues, for example, in Shakespeare and the politics field. He's not interested in Parliament. He barely ever mentions Parliament. He doesn't see Parliament as the solution. It's a king in touch with the people. Shakespeare's politics is very personal. For him, the fundamental question is who rules. And given a monarchy, his full attention is turned to the question of how do you get a good monarch? Not as Hobbes and Locke not how do you create an institutional framework. So again, I don't want to exaggerate his importance as if Shakespeare created the English regime. But it is interesting that as European monarchs go, the English monarchs have been more accommodating to the common people, and that's why they're still sitting on the throne when the Hohenzollerns and the Habsburgs are out waiting tables in Vienna and Berlin.
Well, the successful ones, yeah, the 17th. I mean, England went in a Shakespeare... What you're suggesting is, in a way, a Shakespearean direction. Now, with the revolution in 1688, it wasn't exactly, and the killing of King Charles I, also, it wasn't exactly a smooth thing. But I think, but let's go backwards before, so he also had thoughts going forward. But so it seems to me, if you just take the core history plays, I guess, I don't know if that's a phrase I invented or if it's used anywhere, but so, I mean, they go in consecutively, really, are Richard II, Henry IV, Henry V, Henry VI, Richard III. Yeah. And that seems to be Shakespeare's account, isn't it? I mean, just superficially, if you look at Richard II, it seems to be of, you know, a very Christian monarch and monarchy ending up, well, Richard III, to say the least, isn't Christian. Brutal tyrant, and then he ends up yielding. And then we do have Henry VIII, so this kind of a happy ending, you might say, to these history plays. Yeah. But I do think, don't you think he's showing in the progression from Richard II through the Henrys the development of modern politics in some ways?
Yes, I have an essay.
And not just the monarchy. I mean,
I have an essay on Henry V that's called From Medieval to Modern Politics, that what Shakespeare shows is the movement from feudal monarchy, and that's F-E-U-D-A-L, though it's also futile, as Shakespeare portrays it, from feudal monarchy to something more modern, centralized monarchy. And when you go back to King John already and then start looking at Richard II, the defect of medieval monarchy is it's a divided sovereignty. For one thing, the feudal system means that you've got these barons and other lords who have their own armies, and the king is first among equals and often gets in trouble when the barons decide to take a walk and pursue their own interests. The other great division is church-state. Right. That is the, again, this is something that Shakespeare faces, that Plato and Aristotle didn't. He's showing what happens to politics when you have a transpolitical religion such as Christianity, which makes very powerful but different claims on people's allegiance. And essentially, the narrative of the history plays as a whole is the independence of the Vatican. King John first proposes it, and Henry VIII makes it work. And Henry
the independence
fifth,
from the Vatican, church. Yeah,
yeah. What Shakespeare shows is that politics leads to civil war when the barons are independent, and it leads to civil war when the church claims an independent authority. And the whole working out of the history plays is the barons are killed off in the course of the civil wars, and the church is brought under national sovereignty. It's very interesting that Henry V begins with a scene among two archbishops, maybe a bishop and an archbishop, and they're talking about a bill the king has brought before Parliament. It's one of the few times Parliament's mentioned in Shakespeare, and the bill is to appropriate the church lands and use them to fund a new aristocracy that will be directly loyal to the king. That was Henry VIII's strategy. That was the Tudor strategy centuries later. And Shakespeare sees that Henry V was already contemplating it. The church, to avert that outcome, makes the deal that they'll contribute a lot of money to Henry's war against France and will legitimate it. They'll offer a church argument, a religious argument, in favor of his claim to the French throne. So that shows how much Shakespeare sees as the problem having a national church. Now, you know, this is not so unusual. I mean, this is what Tudor doctrine was. Shakespeare understands it in very Machiavellian terms, how much scheming is involved in it. But I believe that he supported that Tudor policy, which is to have a Church of England, where the head of state is also the head of the church, so that you have a unified nation where people aren't torn in two different directions. Richard II begins in the full medieval world. There's a big tournament going on, great moment of chivalry, and it all turns out to be phony. There's all sorts of wheeling and dealing behind it. Basically, we see the end of the medieval world there and the entering of the modern world where things are settled by very political means. I think Shakespeare, you know, he wouldn't have had the term medieval, wouldn't have had the term modern, but I think what we look at as the medieval world, he saw as a failure politically. That the intrusion of religious concerns into politics was leading to crusades, for example, which his monarchs are still proposing. It was diverting people away from what they needed to do at home. So you can see the secularizing of politics in Shakespeare. That's the way in which you can talk about, more broadly, modernity or modern politics is emerging in Shakespeare's plays.
And I suppose whatever his judgment on it, and I, you know, assuming that he might have been well disposed to some of that, some aspects of modernity and secularization, in any case, it's an account of what happened.
Yes.
And
yes.
Not just, I take it, for Shakespeare, I'm sure he thought about, it may have been what was happening in England, but he must have thought more broadly that it was also
happening in France as well. This is contemporaneous with Baudin.
And he wants to show the movement. So Richard II is this pious and ineffectual king, deposed by Bolingbroke, who becomes Henry IV, who then produces Henry V, who I think is, when I first saw it the first couple times really and read it, you know, it's this great success. It's the one, I guess, of Shakespeare's plays, isn't it, that seems most to be a Arnold Lloyd's success story.
Yes. Yes.
But when you think about it for a minute, it also has a bit of a the limits of political success.
Yes, so, but it's haunted by the fact and said in the final chorus that he died young and we lost everything.
Right.
All the things we gained in France, we lost.
Right.
So it's a good suggestion. Shakespeare is always aware of the chanciness of politics, and the unfortunate premature death of a monarch can destroy everything he stood for.
And also an unjust war in some ways against France, which he gets this, as you said, religious blessing for. But it's not. I mean, he's not as admirable a figure as the kind of normal,
And
you know, view of Henry V as this wonderful, you know, heroic leader.
Yeah, there's the famous business of the killing of the French prisoners, which is bad enough in itself, but Shakespeare sets it up so that Henry first orders the killing of the French prisoners and then reissues the order as if in reaction to something the French have done to give a nice cover to what he's done. Most critics say that's a problem with the text or Shakespeare forgot what he did, but I think that's a very deliberate effort on Shakespeare's part to show something about Henry V. Incidentally, if you look at the sequence you just talked about, Richard is the monarch, Richard II is the monarch, who has this great Christian appearance, but can't back it up with political reality. Henry IV is a Machiavellian schemer and a very effective ruler politically, but he loses all the sanctity of the monarchy by having executed the sitting monarch. The genius of Henry V is that he manages to combine the appearance of a Christian monarch with the Machiavellian abilities of a real political man. And part of, we see that all over the play. And he's saying, oh, I don't deserve any credit for the victory in France. It all belongs to God. Let's sing it, Te Deum here. I think Shakespeare is showing something there that the true king is the king who can combine a pious exterior with, let's say, a Machiavellian interior. Richard III had tried it. He has that scene where he appears with two monks and is trying to, he's saying, oh, I don't want the kingship. I want to pray in a monastery. And, you know, it's so transparently hypocrisy that it doesn't work. But what you could, Henry V is the effective hypocrite because most people don't know who he is. And it is interesting in the movies, the Laurence Olivier version, he omits both orders to kill the prisoners because that looks really bad. And even in the Branagh, he omits the second order. So people, like, you know, good directors understand there's something peculiar going on here. But it's actually those things that are often the key to what's really Shakespeare has in mind.
And Richard III, that's always struck me as, I mean, it's such a kind of gruesome play almost, but one is so put off by Richard III, and he gets his well-deserved comeuppance at the end. But he's, when I went back and looked at it recently, I mean, I hadn't really realized how impressive he is. I mean, how incredibly clever. And
just the energy of it. Well, one of the interesting things in Shakespeare, and we can talk about this when we get to Love, for example, is Shakespeare shows that extremes breed the opposite extreme. And so in this sequence, the Henry VI plays and Richard III, we see in Henry VI an overly pious king, a king of whom people say, you know, you'd be great in a monastery, but you're not good on the throne. And the result of overemphasizing spirituality on the part of Henry VI is to produce this monster, Richard III, who lacks all common compunctions, lacks all common morality. And I think Shakespeare often shows that, that one extreme breeds its opposite. And it's one of the problems he sees with a Christian politics, that it tends to lose the middle. When you demand too much piety from the king, what you produce is a kind of backlash. The pious king becomes ineffective, and these Machiavellians can just eat him for lunch. And, you know, these were real issues in the politics of Shakespeare's day. It was something they saw in Spain. I think very much behind Shakespeare's mind was the abdication of Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, this shocking event in the 16th century when the most powerful man in the world gave up the most powerful position in Europe for the sake of, you know, effectively going into a monastery. And that created all sorts of problems from Europe after that. And the whole history of the Spanish regime, which set itself up as the champion of Christianity in Europe, it produced all sorts of problems, especially for England, the whole Armada episode. There were many things happening in Shakespeare's day which would lead an intelligent person like him to think, we've got to damp down the influence of Christianity on politics. He was not the only one saying this. Again, Baudin was saying it in France. We're going to get it soon in Hobbes and Locke. And I suspect there were people saying in the inner circles in the Elizabethan regime. So it's true. Shakespeare was following, in broad outlines, what really happened. I think he is endorsing it. I think he is showing it a process that was necessary, that England could not settle down and be a nation if it was being torn apart by divided loyalties. And the medieval feudal regime was a formula for divided loyalties.
And I guess with Henry V, the nation gets united in the sense also of the different parts of the nation, right?
Yeah, the one of the striking things in the play is so aware of the differences among the Welsh, the Scottish, the Irish, and the English, and Henry is a master of using the war to bring them together. This is the moment when modern nation states began to emerge, chiefly in France. France was really the first nation state in the true sense of the term, and England was moving towards it during Shakespeare's lifetime. And again, a lot of it had to do with the civil wars eliminating the people who stood in the way. Because what Henry VIII was able to do was replace the sitting aristocratic families with people who were directly loyal to him, and he used the church lands to reward them. But he would take his tailor and suddenly make him the Earl of Surrey. And then he had an aristocracy that flowed from the crown. So instead of the barons making the king made the barons.
And the king not trying to really save the souls of his subjects, but rather, you know, leaving that a little, being a little more relaxed, you might say, about religious observance.
Henry V says on the eve of the Battle of Agincourt about the soul, every subject is his own.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's an amazing statement, but I think it's what Shakespeare's getting at, and Henry's whole argument in that scene is, I can't be responsible for all these souls. I'm just going to win this battle for you, but don't place the responsibility for your soul on me.
So that's a kind of Protestantism ahead of the fact.
Yes, it's there's all these theories that try to claim Shakespeare for Catholicism. I find that most implausible in the light. I think Shakespeare was very much endorsing the movement, in effect, towards Protestantism in England because he saw it as solving this church-state problem. Exactly the sort of thing that Henry VIII was doing in creating the Anglican Church that was happening elsewhere in Europe as well. They wanted to settle the religious question one way or the other so people would not go to war over religious issues. And, that's the view that Hobbes and Locke took and that America is founded on that view. I think you can see, in effect, an argument for separation of church and state in Shakespeare, though at the time that could only be accomplished by the national religion, to just settle the issue. You know, it's the Treaty of Westphalia ahead of time. The king decides what the religion of the country is, and then we leave it at that.
Say a word about the play one of the ones I always liked the most, but the only one I've ever actually taught a little bit, which is Measure for Measure, which is very much, of course, on this top, set in Vienna, which is what the Holy Roman Empire, with a duke who's nominally pious, and the city has gone totally to pot, so to speak.
Measure for Measure is a very strange play, and I actually don't feel I don't feel I understand fully. Really, I don't understand it, but I have some theories about it, and I've certainly thought about it. I always like to start with one fact about Measure for Measure. We're right near the Folger Library here with this great collection of first folios. There is a unique first folio. It comes from Valladolid, Spain. It was used by Catholic deprogrammers. They would get Englishmen who'd been converted to Protestantism, and they wanted to get them back to Catholicism. And they used Shakespeare's plays. They thought this would be a way to teach Catholicism, get people back in the fold of the church. And what's so fascinating about it is we have annotations in it, little bits of censoring, lines that evidently these sort of Inquisition figures thought were heretical, and they wanted to cut them out. Measure for Measure is simply ripped out of that first folio.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, we can't even begin to deal with this one. We just got to rip it out. Now, we can't prove anything from the fact, but it's such a curious fact. When I discovered that, I was just astounded. So, insofar as I understand the play, and, okay, again, set in Vienna, that would mean the Habsburgs. This business of retiring in the city seems to call to mind Charles V. It seems to me it's a play about the impossibility of a fully Christian regime, and that it shows, again, this problem of the extremes. Harry Jaffe has written very well about this in his essay, Chastity as a Political Principle and Measure for Measure, which is in the volume Shakespeare's Political Thinker. That is, the attempt to create a pure Christian morality in the city produces this backlash.
By Angelo. So the Duke steps aside because the city's... Yeah. He's too philosophic. He likes to spend his time allegedly reading or thinking. He's let things fall apart.
Then
he yields to this stern, puritanical type.
And so you get a law against fornication.
Right.
And so in terms of the play, Jaff is very good about this, the nunnery is shadowed by the whorehouse. The heroine, Isabella, is a nun. And then we have whole scenes set in a brothel. With a pimp named Pompey. So you've got a situation where the attempt to maintain chastity produces sexual luxury. And it's as if, again, what's lost is the middle in the play. Women are either chaste or whores. By the way, this is Hamlet's view of women as well. It's this tendency to think of perfection and damnation that Christianity encourages, that a woman is either perfectly pure or she's perfectly damned and whorish. What's missing in the city is marriage, that you could unite sexuality with a morally respectable and civically useful institution. And indeed, that's what the play ends with, people getting married, getting into this healthy, normal, human range of experience. And I think it suggests you can't expect people to give up sex entirely. You don't want them to indulge in sex exclusively. The answer is marriage. That was its whole secret, that it allowed a social, productive life, producing children, to be united with the sexual impulse. So that's my overall take on it. There are a lot of details in the play that still puzzle me, but I do think it's a good illustration of what I was talking about, this danger in a kind of Christian absolutism, that by demanding perfection, you essentially thrust the people who aren't up to perfection into an unregulated and really base way of life.
I mean, it does seem, it's also such a Machiavellian play.
Yes,
The Duke puts this guy in charge who he knows is going to misbehave. I think that's pretty clear when you read the play carefully. He knows already that he's abandoned the woman to whom he had been betrothed or promised to be married because she didn't, I think, have the money that he thought she was going to have. So he's not, he pretends to be a pious guy, Angelo, but he doesn't seem like such a great guy. He overdoes it, by to say the least, and turns out to have lecherous impulses behind all that piety. And then the Duke comes in as the savior, disguised as a monk, I think, or a friar or something. Yeah, and then ends up getting the girl who was at the beginning of the play going into the monastery. So he sort of takes her away from that, seems to. It's a little ambiguous at the end whether she accepts his proposal of marriage. But I've always thought the Duke Well, might have had that in mind from the beginning, that there's kind of a personal plot on the part of the Duke to get Isabella.
And it is like Ramiro de Orco and Cesare Borgia and Machiavelli, that you let someone else do the dirty work and then execute him. And because really the Duke has a problem at the beginning. The city is going to hell in a handbasket. The whole sexual situation has gotten out of hand. So he needs to bring in a guy who will clean it up by going to the extreme. And then the Duke can come in and offer moderation as the solution. And I think that that's a pretty good and Machiavellian strategy on the part of the Duke. Plus, he gets the girl in the end. And again, the superiority of marriage in the resolution of the play.
So if one's interested in Shakespeare's politics, I think the history plays, the tragedies are kind of obviously important, and one can draw lessons about political life and religion and politics and monarchy and republics and all these issues. But I think as someone myself who comes from political life, the comedies seem like a different world and a somewhat more mysterious world. I enjoy seeing them, but I find it much harder to know what to make of them.
I think that's a fair statement, and I think I'm going to get to politics indirectly through the comedies. Shakespeare wrote what's called new comedy, and that means the fundamental comic situation his plays is boy meets girl, boy and girl fall in love, they have problems with their parents, and then finally they get married. He does not write
Is that what Roman new comedy
was? Yes, in other words, it actually goes back to Menander. He does not write old comedy, which would be Aristophanes, where the comedy is overtly and directly political. Hmm. Very interesting that basically he's working in the tradition that comes out of Menander and came to Shakespeare through Roman comedy. Shakespeare's first comedy, Comedy of Errors, is based on a Roman comedy, the Menechmi. And so you have to begin with that fact that the most important thing in Shakespeare's comedies is romantic love. But it does start to get interesting there because he's developing a very profound and thoroughgoing critique of a certain notion of romantic love that was predominant in his culture. It's called courtly love. It's called Petrarchan love. There are many names for it. But it's basically the kind of love that is first developed in the literature of the Middle Ages. It first appears in the 12th century in France in the poetry of the troubadours. It's then picked up in what's called chivalric romance, the poetry of Marie de France, Chrétien de Troyes, late 12th century in France. These are the stories of Tristan and Isolde, so basic to German narrative, the stories of King Arthur, and especially of Lancelot and Guinevere. This is the dominant secular literature of the Middle Ages, this literature of romantic love, and it was a tragic love. In most of these stories, the love is adulterous. It's often a story like Lancelot falls in love with Guinevere, the wife of his queen. Tristan falls in love with Isolde, the wife of his king, King Mark. But they're stories that are not simply incidentally tragic. The love is pointed to tragedy all along because only death can validate the love. These are stories in which love becomes an absolute and infinite value. It's the first poetry we know of, at least in the West, that uses religious imagery of poetic experience. This is when you start to get the idea, oh, our love is like heaven, and we are like saints, and we're on a pilgrimage to love. And you get this domination of these themes in European poetry. Dante picks up on it, and it's the core of his poems about Beatrice, La Vita Nova. It's the core of the Divine Comedy. Petrarch picked up on it, and his sonnets to Laura are examples of this. These are all stories of thwarted love, of unfulfilled love. Love becomes identified with suffering in these stories. It is almost always separated from marriage, though occasionally someone will come along and say, well, you know, marriage does not preclude love. Mm-hmm. There's this famous guy, Andreas Capellanus, who wrote a sort of book we call The Art of Courting Love. And one of his rules is, usually marriage, love doesn't involve marriage, but it's not out of the question. And this is the literary tradition that Shakespeare inherited. It dominated love poetry throughout Europe. It eventually came to England. The sonnets that were written by Henry Howard and Sir Thomas Wyatt. This is the literary landscape he confronted, and I think he set out to do a job on this understanding of love. He saw how dangerous it is. He saw that it takes away love's communal function, or we could say its political function, which is to lead to marriage and repopulate the country. There's something profoundly sterile about this conception of love. It separates it from marriage. It separates it from generation. It makes it seem almost an otherworldly phenomenon. And so I think a lot of Shakespeare's plays are devoted to showing what's wrong with this understanding of love. Now, I'm talking about comedies, but let me mention Romeo and Juliet, because our greatest familiarity with this notion of love is the story of Romeo and Juliet, which has all the elements, not quite adultery, but it's a love forbidden by the parents, and that's why they love it, let's face it. They want to die. They want to die for each other. They're out to prove something. That's the nature of this kind of love. You feel you have to prove your infinite devotion to your lover by dying for him or her. And Shakespeare sets up that play very cleverly, so both Romeo and Juliet get to die for each other. And, you know, it's presented as this tragedy of fate, and yet what is so distinctive is their disaster mentality. They are always one step from suicide. Oh, the party's delayed. I guess I'll kill myself. Mm. Or, gee, she seems to be asleep. I guess I'll kill myself. And I think here Shakespeare is showing the tragic outcome of this understanding of love, that if you want your love to be an otherworldly phenomenon, yeah, it's not going to work out in this world. So in his comedies, he
shows. And also, just in Romeo and Juliet, am I wrong? I just happened to see it. I mean, with such a deep and beautiful love, and of course, yeah. when it's taught that, and there's some truth to that, and yeah. the poetry is so beautiful.
Yeah.
But it's also the case, it turns out, that I guess it's Romeo, right, who had just been in love with someone else
yes.
like 2 weeks before, and yeah. they're basically teenagers, and so yes. it's both very tragic, but it's also superficial
well,
in a
fact,
way.
I mean, when Mercutio, Romeo's friend, hears about Juliet, he says of Romeo, now he is for the numbers Petrarch flowed in. You said your version you saw was cut. Maybe it didn't have the line. But in the text, Shakespeare raises the specter of Petrarch, uh-huh. that this is Petrarchan love. These kids are reading poetry and getting their idea of love from that, and it's disastrous. Today we would say you go to movies or watch television and get your idea of love from that. Shakespeare is very interested in this phenomenon of where life imitates art. And where he saw it in his day, it was in love. That people were getting their idea of love from books, and it was a bad idea. Now, by the way, this is Cervantes' Don Quixote. If you want to see, there was something broader going on here. Cervantes was the second greatest writer living at this time. By the way, it's very curious. Cervantes and Shakespeare died on the same date. They were on different calendars, the Catholic and Protestant calendar, so they died 2 weeks apart, but they died on the same date, April 23rd, 1616.
Is there any reason to think each knew of one knew of the other?
There's no indication that Cervantes knew of Shakespeare. Shakespeare knew of Don Quixote. Shakespeare's lost play, Cardenio, was based on an episode of Don Quixote. Oh. So Don Quixote was known well in England. Anyway, I bring up Don Quixote, maybe to make this point simpler, to see this is what Cervantes was doing. Here, the two greatest writers of the age both saw a real literary problem in their world, that people were getting their ideas of love from books, and it was false ideas, and it was leading to disaster. Now, again, I'll use Cervantes here to give you the bigger picture. What Cervantes combines in Don Quixote is a critique of this romantic idea of love with a critique of medieval chivalry. And that shows you the political implications of this. This is the two-pronged assault on the medieval world. It's given us a false idea of politics. It's given us a false idea of love. And in both cases, they follow from the infiltration of ideas of Christianity into areas like love and politics. And so this is the relation of the history plays to the comedies. The critique of medieval chivalry in the history plays is the mirror image of the critique of this Petrarchan love in the comedy. So it does have political implications. But anyway, looking at the comedies, again and again, you have stories of characters who want to be Petrarchan lovers. And that means they don't want to get together. They're enjoying so much the frustration of being kept apart and all these emotions pumped up. And so Shakespeare shows how these lovers, again, and they crave disaster, they crave suffering. And the comedy is there to get them to be practical. And, you know, they're always, for example, the idea of romantic love, Petrarchan love, Dante, is love at first sight and once and for all. We still have this idea in our culture that there's only one perfect love for you, and, you know, you got to find it. Shakespeare shows how disastrous that belief is, and the comedies, you know, Romeo and Juliet is the formula for tragedy. Romeo and Juliet and Ted and Alice is the formula for comedy. If you can just increase the options, and Shakespeare's comedies tend to take the form of a dance. The characters pair off in mistaken ways that aren't going to work, and they have to learn to reshape their devotion in a practical way. And the principle of tragedy is no substitutes. It's Juliet or nothing. The principle of comedy is Hermia, Helena, which one can I marry? The reason Midsummer Night's Dream ends happily is the lovers are willing to settle for what they originally said was non-negotiable. Tragedy is a world of the non-negotiable. Comedy is the world of the negotiable. And the negotiable in love, where you eventually realize, you know what? The advantage of this woman is she loves me and she'll marry me. As You Like It is wonderful in this way. The main lovers, Rosalind and Orlando, go into the forest. They find this couple, Silvius and Phoebe, who are acting out the roles of courtly lovers. Phoebe is the disdainful mistress of courtly love. Silvius is the devoted follower. And it's going nowhere. And it has to work out that Phoebe falls in love with Rosalind dressed up as a boy. And then be disdained by Rosalind as the boy Ganymede. So she'll learn, you know, it's not so great to be turned down in love. And she'll eventually accept the boy next door. That's one thing Shakespeare shows in these comedies. People won't accept the boy next door. They won't accept the rational marriage. They're always striving for something infinite and absolute and impractical. And so the difference in the comic vision is that Shakespeare allows life to be the governing principle. And that means marriage, generation, the family. And that's the way in which this artificial understanding of love that's promoted in literature actually is performing a politically bad function in the community. It's actually standing in the way of people going about their lives, performing the new normal, natural function of pairing off, mating, having children, and contributing to the continuity of the world. In a world of Romeo and Juliet's, we'd be out in one generation if all lovers can do is commit suicide. And so Shakespeare makes us
and
laugh.
Romeo and Juliet does seem to bring the two together because, yeah, as I think you maybe said, so this the tragic, disastrous love affair happens in a city with a which seems to have a disastrous political order.
Yes,
you know,
and
relatedly.
Yes, it's another case where the city is divided by noble families, also divided by the church. Sure. You see there the friar is working at cross purposes with the prince, and that prince, I think, is a pretty Machiavellian prince. Now, by the end of the play, he's got all his enemies under his control. The warring families have agreed to settle. The friar, the prince has caught him with the goods, and he shuts up that friar, and that friar will do what the prince wants him to do from then on.
Anyway, on the comedies, so
yeah,
right.
So I mean, I think.
But they're set in sort of these mysterious nowhere lands.
Well, that's some, you know, them, yeah. I mean, well, part of that is that Shakespeare wants to look at this problem of love, and the politics would necessarily complicate that. Twelfth Night is particularly interesting because usually Shakespeare puts in some complication. the parents object. Midsummer Night's Dream, the parents want the women to marry other people. As You Like It, there's a feud between the parents. It's funny, I think Twelfth Night is an experiment that said, let's take away all obstacles. And these lovers will create them. You've got Duke Orsino, who's the Duke. I mean, the Duke can't forbid his marriage. He's the Duke. You have Olivia, who's a rich woman. They have no problems. And still, it turns out the Duke loves being rejected. He loves to wallow in melancholy. And Olivier loves having him wallow in melancholy. And they're going nowhere. And what's really interesting in that play is Shakespeare introduces these identical twins, a boy and girl, Viola and Sebastian. And the way it works out is Viola meets Olivia masquerading as a boy, Cesario, and she falls in love with him as a boy, she has to experience, again, what it is to be disdained. This, again and again, Shakespeare's comedies work that way, that these people who are indulging this this masquerade as lovers, they have to understand how it looks like from the other side. Olivia falls in love with Viola in a disguise as Cesario, and the Duke falls in love with Cesario, becomes very close friends with him, not realizing it's a woman disguised. And my formula for that play, and I think it's important in a number of the comedies, is Shakespeare remodels romantic love on the model of friendship. That in this case, Olivia bonds with Viola's Sebastian because it's an unthreatening young man. She feels comfortable with him. She feels in a position of superiority. Orsino bonds with Cesario because he thinks it's a male friend. And they learn to get to know each other. They learn to like each other. They develop a sympathy when they're not playing these roles. Shakespeare's comedies are about people who are locked into artificial roles that they've learned from reading books about chivalry and courtly love, and they got to break out of it. So the comic confusion of identity often brings that about. Olivia falls in love with Sebastian, meeting him in the tamer form of his sister, Viola, and Orsino falls in love with Viola, having met her in the form of Cesario. I can't believe I'm keeping this straight, but I am.
That's impressive.
So in both cases, a friendship develops, and that's what Shakespeare thinks romantic love should be like. It should be between two people who know each other. At the beginning of the play, Olivia and Orsino are conducting their love at long distance. Olivia Orsino writes sonnets and sends them to her, and she marks return to sender. There's no interaction there. Nothing's happening. It's this figure, Sebastian Antonio, that introduced some movement. That's Merchant of Venice. This figure, Sebastian and Viola, that introduced movement. And so on a number of the plays, Merchant of Venice, even in a way, Romeo and Juliet, you see the contrast between friendship, usually male friendship in the play, and these artificial forms of romantic love. And I think Shakespeare is showing what lovers need to do is become friends. They have to know each other as people, not as roles in literature. And a lot of the comedies they reform the view of love by remodeling on friendship, and we can call it a reformation in the religion of love. If you want to connect this to what we were saying about Protestantism, the courtly patriarchal love is a very Catholic idea. Not the Catholic Church actually hated it, but these authors were Catholic, and it grew out of a Catholic situation in many ways. It's very interesting to see in the Protestant England of Shakespeare a turn on this form of courtly love. Edmund Spenser, Shakespeare's older contemporary, wrote his Amoretti. They are sonnets written to his wife. And that was like a revolution in literature. Can you believe it? The guy's writing sonnets to his wife. And it was a very Protestant gesture. And you see this happening a lot in England. You can see in Sir Philip Sidney's sonnets to some extent as well, that they're remaking these Catholic notions of love, these other worldly notions, into something much more practical and compatible with national life. Again, it is a kind of reformation in the religion of love. And now you start to see its connections to the larger politics that Shakespeare's dealing with.
And is there an education of the characters in these comedies, or they just sort of stumble into the right outcome?
The education I was talking about, you know, you're the disdainful mistress of Petrarchan poetry. How would you like to feel disdain?
Yeah.
That's the education. A lot of the identity shifts are there to give people a sense of how it looks from the other side. Now, in As You Like It, again, Orlando meets Rosalind in the disguised form of boy Ganymede, and they form a friendship. He is tongue-tied when he meets Rosalind after his big wrestling victory. She comes on to him. He cannot come up with a single pickup line because he's just overawed. This is the woman I love. I can't speak to her. And so the way As You Like It works out, he meets Rosalind disguised as Ganymede, and they can just talk to each other as man to man. And then Ganymede offers to help him court Rosalind, namely herself, and she takes him through the process, and he starts spouting this poetry. What would you say to your Rosalind? He says, "Oh, I would die for her." And he says, Ganymede says, "Come on, people have died, but not for love." You know, and he talks about the great hero and Leander. You know, Leander, he drowned in the Hellespont. It had nothing to do with love. And she basically takes him through what a woman is like and how she does respond. So yeah, these plays are deeply educational in love.
And isn't it? It seems to me, based on very superficial knowledge, that the women usually either know more at the beginning or certainly get educated much more than the men.
And
that's generally true, I think, of comedies maybe through the centuries, that the women are superior to the men in some ways.
Yeah. One of my students had a wonderful, tragedy is when men rule the world, comedy is when women rule the world. And
true.
There's a profound truth to that, because tragedy is about absolutism and people who die for their principles. Comedy is about compromise, negotiation. It points in the direction of the family. It is, I mean, the women in these comedies are almost always the motive force. Portia in Merchant of Venice, they're bringing about the happy ending because they're willing to see through these artificial poses.
And one has a sense sometimes that the comedies that the men, the men don't deserve the women. The women are superior.
Yes,
I think this is very true of Jane Austen too.
Yeah.
The women are superior to the men.
Yes, yes.
Now they have to end up getting married, and the world is the world, so they settle for, so to speak, for these men. And these men are impressive in certain ways, I suppose.
But Jane Austen is the closest thing to Shakespearean comedy, and she's doing the same thing. She's taking English romanticism and the artificial ideas of love produced out of that, and she's making fun of it. She makes fun of the idea of love at first sight, for example, or makes fun of these Gothic novels and their conventions. These are really interesting moments where, again, there are many points at which life imitates art. There are many ways in which we get our ideas of something as important as love, reading books, watching movies, watching television. And there have been artists like Jane Austen, like Cervantes, like Shakespeare, who see part of their mission as correcting for this. Now, the odd thing is they, in fact, perpetuate romantic love. In fact, Romeo and Juliet is now the main conduit of this idea to our culture, the infinite love. And people romanticize Don Quixote, and we have Man from La Mancha and Dream the Impossible Dream. I mean, in many cases, the heritage of these works, I think, is directly contrary to their original intent. Still, I think Shakespeare and Cervantes accomplished a lot. The sonnet writing died after Shakespeare, at least this enormous vogue for it. Milton continued to write sonnets, but they were political. I think they did a lot to correct the excesses of this literature. But, I mean, it's tremendously attractive, this dream of the perfect love, the once-in-a-lifetime love, the infinite love. So it's interesting that people like Jane Austen have had to come along and start the battle again. A lot of the 19th century novel actually deals with false ideas of love. Dickens is another example of that. So I think this is something that Shakespeare could do. I don't know if he really reformed English kingship or how much he transformed English politics, but I really do think he accomplished something literarily in at least exposing how ridiculous some of this erotic posturing is.
And I think Romeo and Juliet obviously survives, and it's powerful and much beloved play and their movies, but it sort of survives in a way as a, you know, I don't know what exactly. A, it's tragic.
Yeah.
And B, it's sort of, I won't say it's not taken seriously, but it's kind of teenage, you know? It's fanciful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, so it's not really a model the way I take it courtly or chivalric love.
Yeah.
Was thought to be an actual model of how you should live your life as an admirable, impressive human being in the 13th century or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think it's sort of, maybe you have to let it survive somewhat because the instincts
and
passions
are
still there, you
know? What Shakespeare allows in the comedies is a romantic aura to surround these things. You can't reduce it to the barest sexual essentials. I show in my essay on As You Like It that for Touchstone and Audrey, the comic figures in the play, I mean, their ideas, we're in the country, we'd like to have sex, well, we better get married. And then the marriage turns out to be phony anyway. And so Shakespeare, in As You Like It, he's looking for a happy medium between the totally artificial love of Sylvia and Phoebe's, Phoebe and Sylvia's, and the totally sexual love of Touchstone Audrey. And Rosalind and Orlando managed to combine some degree of poetry and spirituality with a recognition of the realities of romantic love. And the god of wedding, Hymen, appears at the end of the play to marry everybody in sight. It's not simply a convention that Shakespeare's comedies end with marriage. Lord Byron had a great comment on that. He said, tragedies end with death, comedies end with marriage. There's really not much difference as far as I'm concerned. But in Shakespeare, that comic ending shows the way in which the community has been freed of artificial conventions and brought back more in line with nature, and that means the natural repopulation of the community.
But also a little sense of what's been lost or what's missing,
yes,
do you
and
think?
I think that's Austin as well. I mean, it's very interesting that people talk about comic relief in Shakespeare's tragedies. I invented the term tragic relief in Shakespeare's comedies. That is, very often at the end of a comedy, somebody's excluded.
Yeah.
You know, the major tragedy is exclusive. Usually the greatest people in the community cannot survive. The community cannot reform if they're still alive. Comedy expels major characters.
Tragedy.
Comedy is inclusive. And it tries to bring people who've been bitterly fighting, maybe to the death, they're brought at the end. But there's always a couple of people, Shylock would be a main example, but even Antonio at the end of Merchant of Venice, but Jacques and As You Like It, Malvolio at the end of the Twelfth Night. That's what I call tragic relief. Shakespeare makes a point of reminding us comedy is not complete. That somebody is always left out of the comic formula. This, by the way, is one of the reasons I think Shakespeare is the only genius at comedy and tragedy. He understood this point. In his tragedies, he always reminds us a bit of comedy. And in his comedy, he always reminds us a bit of tragedy. He's showing us that neither view of the world is complete. It's interesting that the reason people write one or the other is they basically have either a tragic or a comic view of the world. I think Shakespeare stood above that and understood life is never perfect tragedy, it's never perfect comedy, and that his plays are, in that sense, abstractions. These are, in a way, artificial patterns, and he tries to remind us of that artificiality. There's a wonderful moment, the song in Twelfth Night, that's quoted in King Lear as well. Shakespeare is always within the plays moving back and forth between tragedy and comedy.
And is there any play or set of plays that do literally transcend tragedy and comedy? I mean,
that's the Tempest.
Did you bring them together? That's the Tempest.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, now again, these last plays, very complicated what he's doing there. But I believe, and many other people believe, that they are best understood as post-tragic. That is, they're examining what happens after tragedy. This is an odd thing to say, but the nice thing in a tragedy is that you die. Really, if you think about it, you confront this horrific moment. Othello discovers he mistakenly killed Desdemona for the wrong reason. King Lear has seen his daughter Cordelia is dead. You know, in a way, it's easier to die then. And life isn't that way. People often have to live through what we call tragedies. And in a way, the genre we call tragedy offers too neat a resolution by having the death of the hero coincide with the moment of tragic recognition. Lear doesn't have to die when he does. Othello doesn't have to die when he does. And so in these late plays, what Shakespeare was doing is examining what would happen if you lived beyond the tragic moment. By the way, Goethe does this in Faust as well, the relation of Faust to part one. Some of our greatest writers have pursued this question. And so the great theme in these last plays is death and return. Characters who you think have died come back. They're plays about a second chance. Tragedy is when you don't get a second chance. And it's probably not accidental that as he was growing older and Shakespeare was coming to the end of his career, he chose to think about this. Now, these plays are very complicated. And again, I would like to say I don't understand them fully, but mainly I just don't understand them. But The Tempest, I feel I have worked out. And it is Shakespeare's attempt to create a genre that transcends tragedy and comedy. It is often called tragicomedy, and some these plays have been called tragicomedy, and the term tragicomedy was available in the Renaissance. Italian critics spoke of it, so it's not even a word that was foreign to Shakespeare. And Shakespeare is exploring a problem in The Tempest that's very much related to what we were saying about Plato and the Symposium. Plato understands that the problem dramatists have is the need to do exciting things on the stage. When Socrates criticizes drama, and specifically tragedy, in Plato's Republic, he's basically saying that these artists have to show something passionate on the stage or something ridiculous. They have to appeal to the audience's sense of the ridiculous or the audience's sense of what's awesome and tragic. And basically what Plato's indicating, you can't put a philosopher up on stage. There would be nothing more boring than watching a guy think for 2.5 hours. Now, of course, it's the great genius of Plato's dialogue that he found a way to dramatize the life of a philosopher in those dramas. I think Shakespeare, maybe not directly reflecting on Plato here, but to me, The Tempest is about a philosopher king. Prospero is a philosopher who, thanks to his attention to philosophy, didn't pay enough attention to politics and has been deposed by his brother. Now the play is how this man who has pursued philosophy will return to kingship in Italy, technically to his dukedom in Milan, but obviously it's a form of kingship. And Shakespeare is essentially dramatizing a philosopher in this play, but how can he do it? And especially how can he deal with this problem of having exciting action on the play? And there he comes up with a brilliant structural solution that Prospero will create an overplot into which Shakespeare will fit a bunch of his old tragic stories. Ferdinand and Miranda are going to act out Romeo and Juliet again, where they think their parents are opposed to their marriage and they'll do anything for each other. Prospero's brother, Antonio, has already played out Hamlet. He has deposed his brother. He actually, you know, like Claudius and the elder Hamlet, he's tried to kill his brother, come to the throne. The other character, Alonso's brother. Anyway, he's going to try to kill his king. Scene from Macbeth. The play actually echoes lines from Shakespeare's tragedies, and Shakespeare is showing here's all this tragic material, and the difference is that Prospero is in control, and none of these tragic plots are allowed to come to fruition, and as a result, all the focus is on Prospero's genius in manipulating them. It's the genius of a playwright. It's in a way the genius of a philosopher who understands all these human tragedies. That's the way the play solves a dramaturgical problem and also takes us into a realm beyond tragedy. We see a world in which the tragic outcome could be prevented by a philosopher king ruling the situation.
One who has supernatural powers, and therefore maybe, as with Plato's philosopher king, one who would never quite exist.
Yes, exactly.
So I only think Shakespeare can do this. But
The Tempest is a profoundly utopian play. In general, the comedies, as opposed to the tragedies, are utopian because they abstract from a lot of the political facts that prevent these happy endings. But The Tempest is an extreme example of this. This happens in a dream world. It happens on stage. Shakespeare does everything in that play to indicate it's merely a play. It's the only real-time play in Shakespeare. It takes place in the 2.5 hours it takes to stage it. It's remarkable, as Shakespeare's often criticized for not obeying the classical unities. I think this is meant to be his last play, even if it isn't technically the last play he wrote. But I thought he's going out in a flourish. And so you think I can't write neoclassical drama? Here it is. Top this one.
And it's about him in some way, right? I mean,
yes,
his ability to, you know.
And Prospero's ability is a theatrical ability. And it is Shakespeare's translation of Plato's philosopher into Shakespeare's equivalent of it, which is the magician playwright. It's an astounding play.
And it is close to his last play
chronologically? Yeah, you know,
it's late.
It's in within a year or two of his retirement. You know, maybe he wrote Henry VIII later, maybe he wrote Two Noble Kinsmen, though in both cases he was then collaborating with John Fletcher. I think they drug him out of retirement because they were worried about the box office when Shakespeare retired. He was smart, since he was a shareholder in theater. He said, "Okay, I'll keep you guys going." And I think he was trying to train John Fletcher to replace him, and John Fletcher did. Shakespeare was the most popular playwright of his generation. John Fletcher, when he linked up with Francis Beaumont, became as popular as Shakespeare, and the theater company went on to dominate the next decade. But I think The Tempest is an attempt to round out Shakespeare's career.
I'm curious. I mean, Shakespeare is both so accessible in some ways, there are all these wonderful stories and poetry, but also daunting. You know, 37, is that how many plays there are? 38, I guess, depending whether you count the co-authored ones, and such a variety of topics. I mean, you yourself began with the Roman plays, I guess, really, in terms of your serious engagement with Shakespeare. Is that a good idea for other people? I mean,
I think it is, but let me just say that the way to begin with Shakespeare is to see the plays. And unfortunately, productions are not uniformly good, but it's tough to ruin Shakespeare. And most big cities, Washington among them, New York and Boston, have good Shakespeare productions. And there are now many good productions available on DVD, and they're shown on television.
And you don't object somehow as a purist to seeing them on DVD
or on television? No, especially when you can see a better performance on DVD than you can find locally. And so I really do think, you know, begin with any play that moves you. Most of them are moving in one way or another, I think, seeing King.
And watch them rather than read them first?
Yes, I would, because you've got to understand that they are dramas. You've got to really submit yourself to the spell of the poetry. And then see what catches your interest. Now, I'll just say in my case, it's sort of an accident that my junior high school was doing Julius Caesar. And I read the play, and I simply thought this was the greatest thing I'd ever seen in my life. The poetry was so beautiful. The rhetoric was so magnificent. everything about it was introducing me to the world of Rome. It made me want to go out and read about the historical Julius Caesar. It happened again because of my grandfather, that I had some scholarly editions of Shakespeare at home. I began reading Shakespeare criticism in the ninth grade because I was lucky enough to be in a household with so many books because of my father and my grandfather. And I started to see, you know, hey, there's arguments here. And the funniest thing about it is I'm reading in this Arden edition, these are the original 1900 Arden editions of the play, that, yeah, Julius Caesar is good, but Coriolanus is better. And I remember saying, oh, it can't be. Who is this idiot? There's nothing better in this play. What is this thing, Coriolanus? And then one night, I'm listening to WBAI, the radio station in New York, which used to broadcast Shakespeare plays on radio. And I'm tuned in the middle, and I'm listening to this thing, and I've never heard anything like this. This is a rhetoric beyond belief. This is just better than anything. But what is it? And then suddenly there's this point where they give him his new name, and everyone's proclaiming Caius Marcius Coriolanus. And they say, so this is the thing. It really is better than Julius Caesar. It's so funny because these are little accents. But that's I got captivated by this play, and then I read it seriously. And then, of course, I get to Mansfield's course at Harvard, and I get to write a paper on it. And the rest, as we say, is history. But I'll say this much for the Roman plays, that they really introduce us to Shakespeare's greatest genius, which is understanding things alien to him. When he portrays Englishmen well, our reaction is to say, well, that's just the way the English are, not realizing that in many ways he's helped shape English character and he's shaped our perception of English character. But what really struck me from the start was these Romans were a different breed of men and women. And that really meant a lot to me then. I've always liked literature that allowed me to travel, that took me to foreign places and to understand things I didn't understand. And so the nice thing about, for me, studying the Roman plays is it led me to study Rome. And I was reading Machiavelli's discourses on Livy and reading Livy, reading Montesquieu on Rome, reading Roman history. To this day, I read Roman history. I love the History Channel when it shows about Rome. And it turns out I discovered that Rome is central to our civilization, and there's a reason our banks look the way they do, or why we have a Senate,
the Capitol,
or a Chicago Tribune. Mm-hmm. So really, my study of Shakespeare's Roman plays ran in tandem with my study of Rome, and that's the thing I feel about Shakespeare. This is the greatest literature ever written. But it's more than literature. It's teaching us about the world and teaching us about aspects of the world that we're not immediately in touch with. Again, just hearing the rhetoric, you know, friends, Roman countrymen, lend me your ears, and then those fabulous speeches in Coriolanus. It introduced me to just a language, a mode of speech that I'd never heard before, and put me in touch with the ancient world. Which has been so important to me in other ways. It happened that a little later I was reading Nietzsche on the ancients. Walter Kaufmann, the great translator of Nietzsche, is very important. He has a book called From Shakespeare to Existentialism, where he writes an essay on Shakespeare and the ancients and showed how Aristotle's idea of the magnanimous man is relevant to Shakespeare. That was tremendously informative to me and helped me understand Aristotle. But Shakespeare has been my portal into understanding a lot of other important phenomena throughout the ancient world, ancient philosophy. Seth Benedetti, in his book on the Iliad, you know, begins with Coriolanus and says this is our best modern entrance into the ancient world. So again, you can start anywhere you like in Shakespeare. I don't recommend, Titus Andronicus and Merry Wives of Windsor is your best introduction, but even those would work. And obviously all these great plays, Hamlet, Macbeth, King Lear, and so on are great. But for me, the Roman plays had the advantage of showing me that this is a man who's showing us the whole world and not just his own time. And again, I think it's particularly valuable that he opened up the whole ancient world to me, and it helped me in reading Plato and Aristotle and Thucydides and Homer, for that matter, that introducing me to this notion of nobility is in many ways very foreign to this world. I mean, to put it mildly, Coriolanus is not a humble man. And yet Shakespeare makes a case for the greatness and grandeur of his self-conception. And I found that very liberating to understand that possibility. So again, I feel the Roman plays are a good place to begin, but you know, find your way into Shakespeare one way or the other.
Final question. You've taught Shakespeare for 40 years, predominantly to American students at the University of Virginia, mostly, but also at Harvard and elsewhere. I'm curious. I mean, one thing that struck me, I'll just preface by saying, is I think I read a little about this once. I mean, Shakespeare's always been pretty popular in America,
yeah,
which is sort of striking, because you'd think America, of all places, they have no tradition of nobility, feudalism. The ancient world is, you know, yeah, even further away from us than it is, presumably, yeah, from England or Europe. And there's something impressive, I think, about the fact that Americans had a certain taste for this all the way back. But I'm just curious, your students, have you seen much in the way of change in their reaction to Shakespeare overall over this time? Is there something surprising about their reaction to Shakespeare when you teach it, or is it not that different, actually?
Shakespeare is the one permanent star in the firmament of literature. And, you know, I'll react to your statement. You know, it's not surprising that Americans have embraced Shakespeare, because everybody has embraced Shakespeare. There's not a people on the earth that do not enjoy Shakespeare's plays. When I was in Japan in 1991, I saw King Lear in Japanese. It was magnificent, one of the greatest Shakespeare productions I've ever seen. Now, it is interesting. I think the Japanese are closer to feudalism.
Right,
I think Akira Kurosawa's films of Shakespeare, Ron, Throne of Blood, and even the way Kagamusha, which is not directly Shakespearean, I think they are some of the greatest Shakespeare films ever, precisely because he understands feudalism in a way that European and American directors don't. But still, the fact is, these plays genuinely have universal appeal in a way that almost nothing ever has. Shakespeare is able to touch on those common elements of humanity that, in fact, we all share. People weep at many of the same things, like death. They laugh at the same things, like the death of their enemies. But there's enough of common humanity in us, and enough of that common humanity in Shakespeare's plays, that they can speak to people everywhere. At the same time, though, he's able to stretch everyone's imagination to understand ways of life that are alien to them. So I hadn't thought about this, but the only thing I teach where the students continue to respond with the same enthusiasm is Shakespeare. With other things, things vary in time, and you can see trends and fashions, but Shakespeare is a surefire hit. It's funny, I find it kind of symbolic. The first course I ever taught, it was my last year in graduate school at Harvard, it was called Shakespeare in Politics, last fall I had the honor to teach again at Harvard, and I taught almost the same course. It was called Shakespeare and Politics, and so that would be 1970 versus 2000. Yeah, that's about 43 years apart, teaching the same course. I'll get it right eventually, but I do think this is people worry about Shakespeare. People want, oh, we need Shakespeare requirements, and you know, Shakespeare doesn't need our help. You know, it's John Milton, Geoffrey Chaucer. They need our help. That's where you see the curriculum collapsing. Shakespeare stands on his own two feet, and you know, basically, you can't keep students away from Shakespeare courses that are most heavily enrolled at the University of Virginia. They genuinely respond to Shakespeare. The poetry is so beautiful, the drama is so powerful, and they all can relate to it on some of the most basic levels.
That's an appropriate note on which to end. So thank you very much, Paul, for participating in this conversation.
Well, it was my pleasure.